Winston S. Churchill, The Second World War, Volume 6, Triumph and Tragedy. Triumph and Tragedy is indeed an apt epitaph for the Second World War. After 6 years of struggle, Britain and her chief allies, the United States of America and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, emerged victorious, but with the seed of conflict already sown between them. On all fronts, the Allies triumphed, though on some more quickly and decisively than on others. The status of the campaign in Italy continued to be a source of disagreement between the British and the Americans, and my grandfather always regretted the fact that more advantage was not seized from the opportunities he saw for an advance through northern Italy and on through the Ljubljana Gap to Austria and Vienna. He believed that this would be the most effective way of drawing German troops away from the Eastern Front and Normandy, and would also help to limit the Western advance of Soviet forces into Eastern and Central Europe. The latter factor weighed heavily on his mind as Stalin became more difficult and political dangers associated with the advance of communism into Eastern Europe became more evident. Much of my grandfather's time was taken up with trying to deal with the Soviets and to get satisfactory arrangements for those areas that they liberated. Most notable of all were his efforts on behalf of Poland. In his attempts, he often found the Americans lacking in their support for his objectives, and it saddened him that his rapport with Roosevelt suffered as the president sought to deal with Stalin personally on a bilateral basis. The decline of the president's health was no doubt also a factor in this. Against the Nazis, the Allies were winning on all fronts. The Soviets continued their heroic onward march into Germany and on to Berlin. Meanwhile, on the Western Front, there was the last great German offensive of the war in the Ardennes in December of 1944, but it proved to be the beginning of the end of German resistance. In Italy, the Germans finally collapsed, and with them also went Mussolini, brutally executed by partisans. 2 days later, on the 30th of April, Hitler committed suicide in his bunker in Berlin. The 8th of May was proclaimed to be VE Day, Victory in Europe Day. In the Pacific, meanwhile, the Americans prosecuted a two-pronged advance towards Japan. Between October 22 and 27 in 1944, the Battle of Leyte Gulf raged between the United States and Japanese navies. It was a decisive victory for the Americans. They soon retook the Philippines and were poised for the final attack on mainland Japan when the atom bomb was successfully tested and later used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki to bring the war to a swift end with Japan's surrender on the 14th of August 1945. The end had been foreseen for some time, and the Allied leaders had sought at both Yalta and Potsdam conferences to make satisfactory arrangements for the peace. My grandfather had grave doubts and misgivings about the outcome. He felt that the Soviets needed to be handled more sternly, and that the United Nations organization would prove to be nothing more than a talking shop. But there was now little more that he could do. In the British general election, the Conservatives were defeated, and on the 27th of July 1945, Clement Attlee formed a Labour government. My grandfather's great wartime role had come to an end. Of the end of a different war, my grandfather wrote this: "Merciful oblivion draws its veils. The crippled limp away. The mourners fall back into the sad twilight of memory. New youth is here to claim its rights, and the perennial stream flows forward even in the battle zone, as if the tale were all a dream. Is this the end? Is it to be merely a chapter in a cruel and senseless story? Will a new generation, in their turn, be immolated? Will our children gasp again in devastated lands? Or will there spring from the very fires of conflict that reconciliation of the three giant combatants which would unite their genius and secure to each, in safety and freedom, a share in rebuilding the glory of Europe. That was written in response to the end of the First World War. My grandfather knew only too well how the hope for rebuilding the glory of Europe was defiled by Hitler and Mussolini in the 1930s and 40s. After the Second World War, hope for the future was again blighted by the curse of totalitarianism. But I sometimes wonder how my grandfather would now feel and what he would have said about the end of the Cold War and of the present prospects for Europe and the future of the world. Perhaps he would amend triumph and tragedy to triumph, tragedy, and new hope. At least I know that would be in character.
Liberating Normandy was a supreme event in the European campaign of 1944, but it was only one of several concentric strokes upon Nazi Germany. In the east, the Russians were flooding into Poland and the Balkans, and in the south, Alexander's armies in Italy were pressing towards the River Po. Decisions had now to be taken about our next move in the Mediterranean, and it must be recorded with regret that these occasioned the first important divergence on high strategy between ourselves and our American friends. The design for final victory in Europe had been outlined in prolonged discussion at the Tehran Conference in November 1943. Its decisions still governed our plans, and it would be well to recall them. First and foremost, we had promised to carry out Overlord. Here was the dominating task, and no one disputed that here lay our prime duty. But we still welded powerful forces in the Mediterranean, and the question had remained, what should they do? We had resolved that they should capture Rome, whose nearby airfields were needed for bombing southern Germany, advance up the peninsula as far as the Pisa-Rimini line, and there hold as many enemy divisions as possible. This, however, was not all. The third operation was also agreed upon, namely, an amphibious landing in the south of France. And it was on this project that controversy was about to descend. It was originally conceived as a feint or threat to keep German troops on the Riviera and stop them joining the battles in Normandy. But the Americans had pressed for a real attack by 10 divisions, and Stalin had supported them. I accepted the change, largely to prevent undue diversions to Burma, although I contemplated other ways of exploiting success in Italy, and the plan had been given the codename Anvil. But there were several reservations. Many of the forces would have to come from Italy, and they had first to accomplish the arduous and important task of seizing Rome and the airfields. Until this was done, little could be spared or taken from Alexander. Rome must fall before Anvil could start, and it must also start about the same time as Overlord. The troops would have a long way to go before they could reach Eisenhower's armies in Normandy, and unless they landed in good time, they would be too late to help, and the Battle of the Beaches would be over. All turned on the capture of Rome. At Tehran, we had confidently expected to reach it early in the spring, but this had proved impossible. The descent at Anzio to accelerate its capture had drawn 8 or 10 German divisions away from the vital theater, or more than was expected to be attracted to the Riviera by Anvil. This, in effect, superseded it by achieving its object. Nevertheless, the Riviera project went forward as if nothing had happened. Apart from Anvil, hanging somewhat vaguely in the future, some of the finest divisions of the armies in Italy had rightly been assigned to the main operation of Overlord and had sailed for England before the end of 1943. Alexander had thus been weakened and Kesselring had been strengthened. The Germans had sent reinforcements to Italy, had parried the Anzio swoop, and had stopped us entering Rome until just before D-Day. The hard fighting had, of course, engulfed important enemy reserves, which might otherwise have gone to France, and it certainly helped Overlord in its critical early stages. But nonetheless, our advance in the Mediterranean had been gravely upset. Landing craft were another obstacle. Many of them had to be sent to Overlord. Anvil could not be mounted until they came back, and this in its turn depended on events in Normandy. These facts had been long foreseen, and as far back as March the 21st, General Maitland Wilson, the supreme commander in the Mediterranean, reported that Anvil could not be launched before the end of July. Later, he put it at mid-August and declared that the best way to help Overlord was to abandon any attack on the Riviera and concentrate on Italy. Both he and Alexander thought their best contribution to the common end would be to press forward with all their resources into the Po Valley. Thereafter, with the help of an amphibious operation against the Istrian Peninsula at the head of the Adriatic, which is dominated by and runs south from Trieste, there would be attractive prospects of advancing through the Ljubljana Gap into Austria and Hungary, and striking of the heart of Germany from another direction. When Rome fell on June the 4th, the problem had to be reviewed. Should we go on with Anvil, or should we make a new plan? The American chiefs of staff, Eisenhower and Roosevelt, were resolved to mount Anvil, and thereby weaken our effort in Italy. General Alexander, the South African leader General Smuts, and myself wanted to abandon Anvil and push forward the Italian campaign, with the possibility of an amphibious landing at the head of the Adriatic and an advance into Germany's southern flank through the Ljubljana Gap. The matter was warmly and candidly argued, and on the 28th of June, I sent a telegram to Roosevelt to try to break the deadlock. Mr. Roosevelt's reply was prompt and adverse. Roosevelt argued that he wanted to carry out the grand strategy decided upon at Tehran. But it was Mr. Roosevelt's objections to a descent on the Istrian Peninsula and a thrust against Vienna through the Ljubljana Gap that revealed both the rigidity of the American military plans and his own suspicion of what he called a campaign in the Balkans. First, the operation infringed the grand strategy. Secondly, it would take too long, and we could probably not deploy more than 6 divisions. "I cannot agree," he wrote, "to the employment of United States troops against Istria and into the Balkans, nor can I see the French agreeing to such use of French troops. For purely political considerations over here, I should never survive even a slight setback in Overlord if it were known that fairly large forces had been diverted to the Balkans." No one involved in these discussions had ever thought of moving armies into the Balkans, but Istria and Trieste were strategic and political positions, which, as he saw very clearly, might exercise profound and widespread reaction, especially after the Russian advances. For the time being, however, I resigned myself, and on July the 2nd, General Wilson was ordered to attack the south of France on August the 15th. Preparations began at once, but it should be noted that Anvil was renamed Dragoon. This was done in case the enemy had learnt the meaning of the original code word. On the 7th of August, I made a last attempt to modify the assault on the south of France. I met with Eisenhower and urged that the landing should be at Bordeaux and not on the Riviera. I was, however, unable to convince Eisenhower, and the next day I received a message from Mr. Roosevelt, which also insisted that Dragoon should proceed as originally planned. There was no more to be done about it. It is worth noting that we had now passed the day in July when, for the first time in the war, the movement of the great American armies into Europe and their growth in the Far East made their numbers in action greater than our own. Influence on Allied operations is usually increased by large reinforcements. It must also be remembered that had the British views on this strategic issue been accepted, the tactical preparations might well have caused some delay, which again would have reacted on the general argument. I now decided to go myself to Italy, where many questions could be more easily settled on the spot than by correspondence. It would be a great advantage to see the commanders and the troops from whom so much was being demanded after so much had been taken. While in Italy, in addition to military matters, I also had to deal with 2 difficult political problems. The first concerned Yugoslavia. I arranged to meet with Tito and took the opportunity to explain to him our immediate strategy in the Mediterranean. We also arranged for a meeting between him and Mr. Subasic, the new Yugoslav Prime Minister of King Peter's government in London. The other matter was even more sensitive and concerned the situation in Greece. I met Mr. Papandreou, head of the Greek government in exile. The pending German withdrawal from Greece had aroused speculation about the future government of Greece, and Papandreou was much concerned that it should not fall to the communists.